I'd begin to dream in German. And they always say once you dream in a language, then you're sort of making quite a lot of progress in terms of having that language as part of you. But football was always part of it as well.
Welcome in to episode 2 of The Heart of the Game, the show where we get to know the folks who make up the fabric of football. I'm your host, Nate Abaurea. Get at me on Twitter and Instagram at Nate Abaurea, and be sure to follow at World Soccer Talk. In this edition of the show, we're joined by a man who was a great mentor to me growing up, and a man who has long been a prominent and well-respected commentary voice of the beautiful game, my good friend Derek Ray. We talked air travel with Derek Ray. We talked about the art of the freelance hustle as a soccer commentator. We talked French food and Euro pop. We also talked a lot about Germany, German football, and Derek's love for the German language. We talked about the importance of proper name pronunciation and cultural understanding, and we talked about the meaning of football romanticism. So without further ado, on with the show.
Derek Ray, how are you, sir?
I'm very well, Nate. How are you?
I'm doing well. Speaking to you from here on the U.S.-Mexico border in San Diego, California. Where does the world find you today as we speak?
I'm thankfully at home, and I'm not always able to say that, but home is the Boston area, just north of Boston on the coast here in Massachusetts.
Now, something that a lot of people have asked about you over the last few years, and even going back a decade or more, on average, how many annual air miles do you rack up, Derek? I feel like you fly more than any football commentator that I've ever known.
I probably do nowadays, yeah, since moving back to the USA from the UK in 2017. That is certainly the case. I don't really count the miles, but I suppose I should. And I'm just estimating this, but I guess it's probably 100,000 a year.
Oh man, the 100,000 a year estimation there of the miles annually. Much of that is due to, as you said, you're moving back to the Boston area and continuing to work all around Europe, and much of it is working freelance, the quintessential freelance hustle, which is such a cool thing for a man of your experience and career level, that's still the foundation of what you do. And I know you and I have talked off the air quite a bit about this, and I just wanted to share this with the listeners right now. What would you, Derek, say are the greatest benefits of the freelance career that you're living right now?
Well, it was an active decision on my part when I came back here to the USA to be freelance. Now, I know that's not for everyone, but I'm in a slightly different situation. My wife and I don't have children. We had a home here in the Boston area that we had kept during the years when we were living in the UK. And I really wanted to do what I wanted to do, which was work for a variety of people, bounce around different properties, explore different things. And this allows me to do that. And the advantage is that, you know, one week I can indulge my passion for the Bundesliga by working in Germany, which I do quite a lot. The next week, I could be fortunate enough to be asked to work for NBC Sports here in the USA covering the Premier League. And then a different week, I could be doing the EA Sports FIFA game that I'm now privileged to be part of as one of the commentators on that. So those would just be three examples. It's also allowed me, since coming back to the USA, to work the major tournaments. Now, of course, Fox Sports hold the FIFA rights nowadays, the World Cup and the Women's World Cup. So I've been on board with Fox these last 2 years. And that's something that I wasn't able to say during the years when I was working in the USA and had more exclusive contracts with people. So it does allow flexibility. I think you have to be prepared when you are freelance not to be necessarily the lead commentator, the number one commentator on every event, but it does give you the chance to bounce between channels because my deal, for example, with NBC is not exclusive. Similarly with Fox, when I did the World Cup and the Women's World Cup, non-exclusive. So that would be the big benefit, and I absolutely love it, and I think it suits my way of working and my personality.
Just for the sake of duality, Derek, what would you say are some of the greatest challenges in this new era of your work?
The challenge is that you are always planning and always thinking about how you're going to fit something in. And that sometimes involves calling multiple people, because if you commit to doing something in a different country, in my case, often Germany, and being away for 10 to 12 days, it could mean that you're at the same time missing out on work that could come your way here stateside. So it's, sort of juggling all the time and thinking, okay, where do I want to be? What's best for me this particular week or that particular week? And, you know, sometimes you do miss out on opportunities because you are in one place or another. But to me, that's well worth it. And as I say, it's really what I wanted to do. And of course, there are times when you simply want to say, no, I don't want to take on any work this week. and that's how I operate. And I do drive myself quite hard. When I'm in Europe, I do tend to load up on events so that it could be, for example, I was in Germany and England quite recently, and I gave myself a pretty heavy schedule during that time. And when I came home, I said, okay, when I come home, then I'll have a few days off. So it's, as I say, it's not for everybody. A lot of people like the security. They like the sort of the regular way of working and having a couple of days off and then working 4 or 5 days. So this is different, but I'm no less passionate than I've always been. It's just different in terms of the rhythm and the structure and the base being back here in the USA. But it was something that we spoke about and I was very keen to do, having really, in my opinion, felt that I'd done everything that I'd wanted to do in the years in the UK.
We're going to talk quite a bit about German football in the Bundesliga, something you've already alluded to. But before we go there, I want to go back to the last two summers of 2019 and 2018, summers that will kind of just live on forever. They were very special, and you got to play a very special part in them as a commentator. The last two World Cups and going back to back. With the Men's World Cup in Russia and then the Women's World Cup in France. Talk about what that year span was like and maybe the juxtaposition of the two tournaments for you and what they meant.
Yeah, well, I honestly didn't know if I was going to be able to continue my run of covering World Cups. And I've had a role in every World Cup, one role or another, going all the way back to 1990. Now, in most cases, it's been as a commentator, but not every World Cup as a commentator. For example, in 1994, I was part of the organizing committee as one of the press officers for the World Cup organizing committee. 2002 in Korea, I was one of the FIFA media officers. So I've had different roles as well as being a commentator. But in recent years, it's been more as a commentator. And certainly with ESPN 2010 in South Africa, 2014 in Brazil. But I began to doubt whether the opportunity would come my way. And it's, you know, perfectly natural. I had no real affiliation with Fox. I hadn't done anything specifically for Fox. And again, the reason for that was I had a deal with ESPN. But just as we were actually embarking on a trip around Europe to end our spell in the UK in the autumn, in the fall of 2017, I got a call from Fox through an associate, through somebody I've known for a long time who I've worked with on various other projects, who was part of the Fox team. And the upshot of it all was there is interest from Fox in talking to you about the World Cup. And of course, naturally, I was thrilled to have that conversation. And we did, and it evolved over the course of a few weeks. And then the next evolution, and this didn't really happen until, I'm going to say, towards December or January, so January of 2018, the next evolution was that they wanted my co-commentator to be Ali Wagner. Now, I didn't know Ali at that time. Obviously, I knew all about her footballing accomplishments, having observed them. But I was very intrigued because I'd heard her on the year before. And I have worked with many women co-commentators down the years, broadcasting women's football when I was in England for BT Sport and ESPN UK, and even in the years prior to that in the USA, doing quite a lot of women's football, including the Women's World Cup in 1999 and again in 2003. So Ali and I spoke a lot, and you know, we became friends and did a few trial games together. And it became apparent to me that we were going to get along very well on the air. And I liked her work ethic, her approach to it. Very diligent, put so much time and effort into it, wanted to know every single thing about every single player, all their traits. And we would talk a lot about that, you know, not necessarily on the phone, but by email and text. And, you know, we became a team. And that's something I've always prided myself on, is being a team player. You know, sometimes I feel I'm the captain of the team, sometimes depending on the personality of the person I'm working with, then, you know, they can be the captain of the team. In this case, I just felt that we gelled quite well, and the response to it was very positive. And we began that World Cup with Morocco against Iran. That was our first game, and we went all the way to the quarterfinal, which was England against Sweden, which we did together in Russia. And nothing but great memories of that. And as I say, I really enjoyed the time working with Ali in Russia. And after that, then I was asked, well, you know, we've got the Women's World Cup next year. Is that something that would interest you as well? And of course, I said, yes, naturally, in France, and not being new to women's football at all, although I hadn't broadcast the Women's World Cup since 2003, since those earlier editions, one for ESPN and one for the World Feed. So women's football is something that I've always followed, as I say, covering the Women's League in England and previously those Women's World Cups. So that was exciting. And it was great to be able to sort of throw my lot into that. And, you know, you asked earlier about the freelance world. That's when being freelance can come in handy, because I was able to block off a lot of time, just my own time, the first few months of 2019 for Women's World Cup prep. And not everybody can do that, because if you've got a day job, then you try to squeeze all that in. I had, you know, a few weeks where I said, okay, the next 3 days, I'm going to do nothing but watch women's football. I'm going to do nothing but watch games from the last year. I'm going to talk to people. And so that's how you sort of get your enjoyment out of it, is by doing that sort of planning, by being ready when the tournament comes along. And my co-commentator was Danielle Slayton on this one. And again, same sort of thing with Ali. Danielle and I began to talk and, you know, compare notes. And Danielle, very detail-oriented, great partner, and wonderful memories from our time working together in France. And I should say, both in Russia and in France, great production people who we had working with us and helping us to sound as good as possible on the air. So, so yeah, it's nice to be able to work with new people. And that's what I have done. Been able to do these last couple of years at the biggest tournaments of them all for men's football and women's football.
Well, you and Ali were a fantastic duo back in Russia 2018. You and Danielle, much the same in France 2019. And the last thing I got to ask you about that, you and Danielle were quite culinarily inclined during that tournament. I was enjoying the trading, the constant trading of food picks from the U.S.-Mexico border all the way out to France. What was your favorite food memory with you and Danielle, or even riding solo from France 2019, Derek?
Well, I think poor Danielle was sick of some of my culinary tastes, because I'm from Scotland, and yeah, I do like fine French cuisine. I'm open about that. But in Scotland, we sometimes like things that are not necessarily fine dining as well. And the one thing I introduced my production team to, Danielle included, of course, was something that exists in northwestern France. And when we were in the northwest of France, in Rennes in particular, this is something that you can get anywhere. And that is the galette saucisse. And a galette saucisse is basically the Breton hot dog. So I would always go looking either before or after the matches in Rennes for a galette saucisse. And there was actually one of the games, that would have been the last game that we did in Rennes, one of the games where we were all driving off in a van, and we saw this stall just outside the stadium with a queue of people and all serving nothing but galette saucisse. So I went out and I said, I am buying for everybody who wants one. And I don't think everybody wanted one, but there were a couple of takers. And so that would be my memory of eating in France. But I have to admit, we were very lucky because we got to travel up and down the country from the north to the south. We had a couple of days in Nice, where the cuisine is very different. As I said, over in the west and in the Breton region, where things are a bit different too. So we did really enjoy our travels as a group.
Well, I shared a great exchange with Danielle towards the end of the tournament, and she said that she learned surprisingly as much about French cuisine from you as she did about your any of your football knowledge. So cheers.
French cuisine, and also if you were to ask her now, she would say she now knows a lot more about French and Euro pop generally from the 1980s than she ever cared to know, because I did insist on having that on the car radio a lot. And I'm sure that the first couple of times she thought to herself, who is this crazy person I've been paired with on the air? But it's all about expanding horizons, isn't it?
Exactly. That's what we like to do. We like to expand horizons here on the podcast and everywhere else as well. Derek Ray, we're wrapping back to Germany. And you alluded to the Bundesliga and German football. And I want to share a quick story with you. A couple of weeks ago, I was hanging out with some folks who are big Bundesliga fans here in San Diego, members of the FC Bayern supporters group. And we have to realize, for someone like myself, not everyone is intently listening to the football commentators the way that I often am. You and I have joked about that many a times. Many of football commentators joke about that. Not everyone is tuning in for the commentator the way that Nate might be. A lot of people are just tuning in for the game itself. And when you get folks who are deep fans of teams, and when they pick up on the commentators and they're kind of experiencing the commentary for the first time, you can get some really interesting insights. And I'll never forget a couple of weeks ago, these two lads from the Bayern group have been watching Bayern for years, and they were talking to me going, oh yeah, commentators, we're talking about football commentators. And they go, you know, that Scottish guy who does a lot of the Bundesliga games, that dude's really good. And you know what else I really noticed? He knows a lot about Germany. Like, wow, that guy knows a lot about Germany. Like, is he part German? That's what they were asking. I was like, oh, you're talking about Derek Ray. You're talking about one of my mentors. You're talking about a guy I've got a world of respect for. No, he's actually a Scotsman through and through, who sort of adopted Germany as a second culture of his. And so transitioning this right back to the interview, Derek, I want to ask you, what German football means to you, because it's so clear that it comes across in your commentary to people who have heard you 1,000 times and people who are hearing you for the first time. They hear your love for Germany and your love for German football when you call Bundesliga games. And I'd like to get some insight into where that love for German football comes from.
Well, first of all, if that love does come through, then I'm very happy as a broadcaster, because the love is genuine. And it goes back to my younger days. My favorite subject at school, my best subject, was German. And to be honest, I thought that's probably where my career would take me. That's rather than being a football commentator, which was, you know, my dream, but you never really think you're going to get to realize your dream. I thought that my future probably would be something linguistic, probably something in the field of translation or teaching, and probably as a German translator or teacher. So I really did have this sort of German obsession from a very young age, and it goes all the way back to the 1974 World Cup, which is the first major tournament that I watched on TV. And that's, I think, when I first discovered the magic. And it wasn't long after that that German happened to be the language that we learned in my class at school in Scotland, at primary school, and continued that into secondary school and then at university. Now, my German teacher, who was very important to me in terms of, you know, my interest in the language at that time, a guy called Brian Steele in Aberdeen, sadly no longer with us. He had a contact with a teacher in a very small village, which happened to be right on the border of the two Germanies, as was the case at the time, East and West, on the western side. But when I say right on the border, I mean you know, a couple of hundred yards from the border. So in other words, from the living room, you could see the East German border guards on the other side looking over to the west with their binoculars. So it was a sort of fusion of mystery, of international espionage, of a real joy in German, and that certainly was at the heart of it. I mean, when I would spend time in Germany, and I did go to this area of Germany and got to know it much better, I'd begin to dream in German. And they always say once you dream in a language, then you're sort of making quite a lot of progress in terms of having that language as part of you. But football was always part of it as well. And when I went there as a student, I would make sure I would go to games. And the first games I went to were second division games. The closest team, a team called Hessen Kassel back in the 1980s, who were pushing very strongly for promotion, never quite made it. But I fell in love with them early on. I also sort of had a thing for Köln, who were one of the better teams in Germany at that time. And they had players like Pierre Littbarski, Thomas Hessler, Toni Schumacher, the great goalkeeper. People like that. And even though we weren't close to Köln, that was always sort of at the back of my head that there was something magical about Köln. So this continued right the way through my life. And I got into broadcasting and international football broadcasting and always, used my German whenever it was advantageous, as it could be sometimes in those days calling FIFA or UEFA, because it wasn't necessarily a given that you would call up and get somebody talking English when you wanted to have something clarified. So I would always use my German, and there were times when it would come in handy, but never really on the broadcasting side, unless a Scottish team was playing a German team. And I was lucky enough to cover a few of them in the late 80s, early 90s, in the early years of my broadcasting. And then again, when I was in the USA with the Champions League, when it would be a Bayern game, my eyes would light up, because then I genuinely felt I could give something a little bit extra. And for me, the football is all part of this German cultural thing that's with me. And I do try to do that. And if it comes over on the air, I'm delighted, as I said, because to me, part of my job as a world feed commentator, as I am now when I'm working for the Bundesliga, and that's directly for the league itself, part of the job is to be to educate people around the world, not just about the football, not just about the teams, that's very important too, but about Germany itself. Because it's funny, I sat down with a young student who was looking for some advice recently, and he was very interested in German football, knew a lot about it. But one of the questions that he had for me was, what's Germany like? Just tell me about Germany. How is it different in comparison with the US, for example? And it's when you listen to people like that, you realize that, most people don't have that advantage that I have. I've spent big chunks of my life working at these places, at these grounds, and walking through these cities and talking to people and, having friends and contacts in these cities. And I do believe that knowing a language allows you to take it to another level, that you know what the currency of conversation is on a daily basis in Germany in a way that somebody who doesn't know the language can't possibly provide, so that's where it kind of comes from with me. And as I say, it's only really in recent years, since I moved to the UK, that's when Bundesliga rights were with ESPN UK and then with BT Sport, where I worked. And I obviously said to them, if there's a chance, I'd love to do as much Bundesliga as possible in addition to my other duties. And they were very good to give me that. And then the Bundesliga World Feed people got wind of the fact that I was interested in working for them. And they're a great group of people, by the way. They are, really some of my favorites of all the people I've ever worked with. And I'm talking about fellow commentators and producers. And it's just a true team effort. And, we share the workloads, and no one person gets all the top matches. It's a really nice mix. So I love going to Germany as often as possible. So that's a long-winded answer about my love of all things German and all things German football wise, but it's a relationship that I hope we can continue for a long time.
Well, we're not done talking German football yet. If you're on a show with me, we're going to get a little nostalgic. We're going down memory lane. You talked about this. You talked about the 74 World Cup. You talked about those matches that influenced you, where you kind of cut your teeth with German football during your formidable years. looking more into the modern era and into your career as a broadcaster all the way to right now, what are some of your favorite German football memories, Derek?
Well, the one that absolutely stands out actually was only a couple of years ago. So it was, again, it was not long back in the USA, and I went back to Germany to do a block of matches. And one of them was my favorite derby. And I've been lucky enough to cover this fixture several times now, either from Dortmund or from Gelsenkirchen. I'm talking about the Revier Derby, as it's known, the big derby in the Ruhr region, the industrial part of Germany, Borussia Dortmund against Schalke 04. And so I went to Dortmund for this game, and I was working with the great Stefan Freund, my co-commentator. And this was one of those games that really, you and I have spoken about the madness and the greatness of the 2005 Champions League final in Istanbul that I was lucky enough to commentate on. And I always said, there'll never be a major final quite like that. Well, I wasn't sure there would ever be a game quite like that. This is the closest that I've really had that rivals that one. And I say that because it was 4-0 to Borussia Dortmund at halftime and absolutely running away with it. And the final score was 4-4. Schalke came back from 4-0 down at the home of Dortmund at the Signal Iduna Park. And with just about the last touch of the game, a header by Naldo, they made it 4-4. And to be able to broadcast that to a world audience and to have it all there in front of me in Dortmund that day, it would be difficult for me to say that wouldn't be my favorite memory. I have another one actually from last season, and it was one of the worst games that I've ever commentated on, but the story was just amazing. And that was, and again, this ties into my interest in East Germany in particular, that was the night when Union from Berlin, FC Union, Eisen Union, as the fans call the team, made it to the Bundesliga for the very first time. And they did it against all the odds, against Stuttgart. I'd covered the first leg in Stuttgart when it was 2-2, and away goals did count. So they went back to their wonderful stadium, which is a throwback to many decades ago, the Stadion an der Alten Försterei in Köpenick on the eastern side of Berlin, southeast Berlin. And it finished 0-0. It was scrappy, scruffy. Choose your adjective. There was nothing positive about the game. But the celebration was the like of which I have never seen. Pitch invasion en masse. It lasted. It seemed as though it lasted for hours. And Stefan and I commentated on this pitch invasion. And what you have to remember is that this was the team of the trade union movement in the former East Germany, where there was quite a lot of dissent. And a lot of people who were dissenters were quite attracted to Union. They were not part of the establishment. You know, the establishment, the Stasi team in East German days were Dynamo, who won everything. And a lot of the reason for that was because it was fixed, because they got the best players, and it was taken care of that they would win most things latterly in the former East Germany. Union didn't win very much at all. Apart from one memorable cup in the in 1968, the cup final. But really, for them to then suddenly have made it to the Bundesliga, just to me, was one of the most romantic stories I'd ever covered. So we've got two in the last couple of years, and who's to say what comes next? But, you know, if I go all the way back, you know, the first memory, really, the first sort of memory as a student was another one that that still stays with me. And that was when I was staying with a family right on the border, as I said, in Wildeck-Hörnebach, which is, if you know your geography, is, I say, not far from Kassel, a bit closer to Bad Hersfeld and Debra, but nowadays on the border between Hessen and Thüringen, and Thüringen would be the eastern side. Bayern and Gladbach in the final of the German Cup, and it was the last of the German Cup finals before they went to Berlin on a permanent basis. So this was at the old Waldstadion in Frankfurt. And I had actually gone to my first, I was to go to my first game at that stadium, first Bundesliga game, not long after that, the first top flight game, which was Frankfurt against Bayer Uerdingen. But this one featured the great Lothar Matthäus, who was in his last game as a Gladbach player before joining Bayern. And it went to penalties, and unfortunately didn't work out for Mr. Mateos in that penalty shootout. But just something that will always stay with me. And when I think of German Cup finals, and it's one of my favorite days on the calendar, the DFB Pokal Finale, as they say, the German Cup final. I always go back to that one in the mid-80s when it really all started for me as a viewer.
You're talking geography, you're talking culture, language, food, football romanticism, and the intersections, and the intersections of all of those things, and how they all tie together to your love for the beautiful game and your love for what you do as a football commentator. And that's one more thing I want to ask you about, and bouncing off some of our personal conversations that we've had over the years. What does it mean to make sure? How important is it for you to make sure that all of those things that I just mentioned, geography, culture, language, food, football, romanticism, that they stay intertwined and that soccer, football, whatever you want to call it, doesn't become this sort of separate entity, that it stays intertwined as a part of life? What does that mean to you, and how important is that to make sure that comes through your work?
Well, to me, it's paramount. What I always try to bring across, because I've been lucky enough to be at most of these venues where I commentate from as a fan, and it's a different experience as a fan, because when you're commentating, you're thinking about getting everything right, and you're not in the same frame of mind as you are when you're a fan. So I deliberately take days where I just go to a game as a fan, and I experience the whole day that way. So, you know, if I'm going to a game in, let's say, in Cologne, in Köln, then, you know, I'll make sure that I, you know, a couple of hours before the game, jump on the local train with the fans and listen to conversations and get off, you know, a couple of stops before and go and sit down with everybody, having a beer and a bratwurst, and just listen and imbibe. And, you know, I firmly believe that, and some people say to me, oh, why did you talk on the air about, you know, about the shuttle buses that take the fans to the, nobody's interested in that. And I'll say, well, it's all about painting a picture, and we all do it our own way, and you don't want to bore people with anything. But at the same time, if you have a bit of knowledge that you can share that can bring it home to somebody, then I think you should share it. And this is why I always say to young commentators, you know, do it your own way. There's a structure that you have to use in order to be a good commentator. Of that, there is absolutely no doubt. But put your own stamp on something. And if you have a particular interest in a certain area, if you have knowledge, then use that to good effect. Again, without overdoing it. And that's always the trick. Don't overdo anything on TV. But right place, right time. And I'll never tire of doing that. And it's part of why I really enjoy covering the major tournaments. When we were in France during the Women's World Cup, you know, I made sure that I knew everything and then some in terms of what I needed to do to know, not just about the stadium that I was working from, but about the city, about the surrounding area, about, as you've referenced earlier, the cuisine, the wine, you know, you name it. All that stuff is important. And there's always somebody who's watching and listening who will enjoy that, who will say, you know what, you come at it from a slightly different perspective. You told me something that I didn't know. And I appreciate that. So, you know, football, if you think about football, people, yes, they go to football to watch a game, but it is also a cultural experience and a social experience. You know, you're sharing it with other people. And that's really what I try to do when I'm on the air.
And going back to culture and language, the components that those are of everything that you just talked about right there, it's much more than just German football for you. It's every football match that I've ever heard you commentate for, every year that I've ever known of your existence as a commentator. One of the first things as a kid, and one of the things I look up to you regarding now, is your pronunciation of names. And it's a relentless effort to get every last name 100% correct. And speaking as someone with a name that has been butchered for my entire life, and I've been Nate Abreu, I've been Nate Abaria, I've been Nate Abrera, and God knows what else in my young life, and that's as a commentator, that's in my career, that's as a little kid in school, and so on and so forth. So that's why a commentator like yourself and your relentless effort to make sure that no name is ever mispronounced and no cultural nuance is ever overlooked. And I think there's a lot of people who feel that way, and I want to ask you about that right now in regards to Latino names, in regards to German names, in regards to African names, wherever the name may come from. Talk about how important that is for you to have proper pronunciation and what pronunciation means when it comes to names of human beings.
Well, it's something, as you said, that I place a heavy importance on, and that's just the way I feel about it, probably influenced by my languages background and wanting to get it right. And it first struck me when I was, you know, a very keen German student, it struck me that listening to a lot of commentators in the UK, who I respected greatly, that they weren't getting the German names right at all. You know, they were miles off. And I was thinking, why is that, you know, so hard? Why don't they talk to somebody? Why don't they have a contact, a German contact, who can put them right? I'm talking here about, you know, fairly basic, you know, German names of the time that were being mispronounced. So I've always taken it as a goal going into an event that I want, if there's somebody who is watching, listening from a particular country, and I am pronouncing a name from that country, I want that person to go, oh, that commentator's actually got the name right for a change, you know, because, you know, listen, it's not always easy and it's not always highest on people's priority list. You're checking so many different things, and a lot of people, you know, won't necessarily go the extra mile with that. And, you know, it's also very easy just to go along with what everybody else has said. I find that a particular problem in the UK, I must say. Mm-hmm. What usually happens is, and I used to get involved in a lot of discussions with people about this, what usually happens is people will cluster together. And the question will be asked, well, what are we calling him? And I used to always say, well, should the question not be, what is his name? You know, it's not up to us to impose a name on somebody just because that happens to be easy. Now, I will admit that there are times when players don't make it easy at all. They don't make it easy one bit. I'll give you an example. Borussia Dortmund's Norwegian sensation, who has just joined the club. Now, I know because I did his name for FIFA 3 years ago, and I checked with Norwegian sources. His name in Norway is Erling Haaland. Erling Haaland. Now, he gave an interview very recently where he said, yes, that is my name. But he said, but we're not in Norway anymore. And I actually quite like the way Haaland sounds, and I'm used to it. So that is a nightmare for a commentator, because we're trying to do it the right way. And then somebody will say, a viewer or a listener will say, you're saying it the wrong way. The one where I get most feedback, and it's actually been in the last few weeks since he joined Manchester United, is a player who I did for the FIFA game a couple of years ago. And again, in Portugal, it's Bruno Fernandes. Bruno Fernandes. Bruno Fernandes. Actually, I think it sounds quite good that way. Bruno Fernandes.
It really does.
Yeah. But try getting people in England to agree to that, you know, not going to happen. And so, you know, he has become Bruno Fernandes in England. But my attitude is, and I've been encouraged by the people I work with at EA Sports on this one, my attitude is, this game is going around the world. If his family, members of his family, are playing the game, they want to hear it said the way they say it. They don't want an imposed pronunciation. And I remember it really hit home with me when there was a player in Scotland, when I was working in Scotland, there was a player who had bounced around the scene in England and Scotland for a while. And he was French, but he was of Moroccan heritage. And I'd only ever heard him called Farid El Alagui. A-L-A-G-U-I. El Alagui, they were saying. So I introduced myself to him one night, and I said, could you just confirm the pronunciation of your name? I said, I hear everybody saying El Alagui. He said, no, El Alagui. And I said, well, that's what I thought it would have been because of your French. He goes, yeah, El Alagui. And I said, well, I'm going to say that on the air tonight. He said, thank you so much. He goes, my father's watching, and he will be thrilled. And the next week I saw, or maybe not the next week, but the next time I saw him, we chatted again. He said, thank you so much. He goes, that really meant a lot. So It actually can get you into trouble with viewers because the number of times, and you might think this is crazy, Nate, but the number of times I get tweets from people on social media, you need to learn how to pronounce the names. And I don't really know how to reply to that because you know me, and you know that is one thing that I probably put more time into than certainly most other commentators. But it can come back to bite you if you say a name in a way that is different than the quote unquote accepted way, which, you know, is not always wrong, but can be wrong.
Well, that Alagi story definitely hits home for me. I've heard similar stories here in the cross border community in San Diego and Tijuana. It's something I've heard other examples of similar stories many times, and we've kept this pretty mild mannered. We've kept a pretty mild mannered interview. So without getting us too riled up here, I feel like I have to ask you. You almost went there. You talked about people saying, hey, you need to learn how to pronounce the names. What goes through your mind, Derek Ray, when you hear something that I've heard many a times, that our friend Maximiliano Bretos has heard many a times, a good friend of the show, many other commentators who are so deeply invested in proper pronunciation. What goes through your mind when you hear someone say, could you try to not overpronounce the names of the players? I know you've heard that one before. What goes through your mind when you hear that?
What goes through my mind is that, first of all, you get quite annoyed when you hear that, because the first question I have for somebody who says that is, okay, do you speak German, for example? Somebody's saying I'm overpronouncing a German name. Do you speak German? No. Okay, so who are you to tell me I'm overpronouncing something when I speak that language and you don't? That's the first thing that goes through my mind. And I don't think that we should be underpronouncing names, put it that way. I think that if we can pronounce names correctly, we should pronounce them correctly. I also recognize that not everybody has linguistic ability. So I get that. But I don't think that anybody should say to somebody who happens to have an authentic pronunciation of a name, you are overpronouncing that name. You know, for example, German's a complex language, and you know the U sound and the H sound, and you know the German R. A lot of these sounds, some people just can't make. I get that. You know, I'm lucky enough that I studied the language when I was young, and through studying that, and also because I'm Scottish, and actually we're quite lucky as Scots because we can make a lot of guttural sounds that most other people can't. And I always say to fellow Scots, you guys actually really should be quite good at languages because you can make these sounds, you know? Most people can't make the sound. It's just impossible for, you know, try getting an English person to say that. It's almost impossible. Same for a lot of Americans. They just can't make that sound. It's nobody's fault. But, you know, there are some sounds that we can make, and we grow up making them. So it's, I think, as I said earlier, be yourself and play to your own strengths. And if languages happen to be one of your strengths, then use that to your advantage. And as I say, I always get a little bit, my heart sinks when I hear fellow commentators saying things like, well, yeah, okay, I know that that's not the way he says it, but I'm just going to go with the majority. I'll say, well, why? You know, why not try and be right? And, you know, listen, there are times when we get led up the garden path, and clubs can often be the great enemy on this one too, because they will put out a pronunciation that is wrong, and they'll put it out just because they think that, you know, people are not going to be able to say it correctly. So the sort of the halfway house pronunciation gets put out. I mean, you know, Arsenal had a goalkeeper in England for a long time whose name for some reason got interpreted as Chesney, you know, and his name is Szczęsny. You know, there's two sounds at the first couple of syllables, and then there's an N in there, a soft N in Polish. But, you know, I've said that on the air, and you know, I've had pushback from people saying, oh, you're getting his name wrong. You need to learn how to pronounce his name. Listen, after a while, it's a bit like water off a duck's back. You realize that there are people who are just always going to say that. And if they want to believe you're mispronouncing the name, well, I sometimes come back with them with this line, with the following line is, you really think that I would say it that way if I hadn't checked it, or if I didn't know that's how you pronounce it, you know? So it's frustrating, but unfortunately, it's, you know, you make a stand in this life, and you either, on pronunciations, you either make a stand that you're going to go the whole hog and do it right, or you don't. And I respect that a lot of people feel that they shouldn't, that they ought to approximate, and they ought to say something that's understandable to most people. But I just happen to feel, in line with my penchant for cultural experiences during games, that as far as possible, full stop, I want to get it right.
Well, I think I speak for quite a few people, but I just want to speak at the very least for yours truly, Nate Abaurea, when I say thank you for your unwavering effort in these regards. And thank you for weaving anger, humor, and education in to that last answer. And we're going to end on a very positive note. The terminology, something that you and I have talked about for so long ad nauseum. It's two of my favorite words in the English language, and that is football romanticism, the concept of football romanticism, and romanticismo de fútbol in Espanol, however you want to go about it.
Yeah.
First off, I want to know how to say football romanticism in German, and then I would like to close out this episode of The Heart of the Game. I would like to hear Derek Ray's definition, his own personal definition of football romanticism and what it is.
Well, let me deal with that one first of all. Football romanticism to me is many different things, actually, and it doesn't necessarily have to do with the highest level of football either. To me, romanticism could be watching a game in Scotland by the North Sea, right on the North Sea, with the waves howling and the wind audible as well. I say only a few hundred people watching, and everybody getting the thrill of watching their local team and just taking in the scene. And that to me can be as romantic as just about anything. It's the one thing when I worked in Scotland, I used to do a lot. I used to go to games at small grounds, small places, when I wasn't working during the week. And I just wanted to take in the scene. And I actually got more romantic joy, if you like, out of these smaller grounds than I would at a big stadium. Now, don't get me wrong, I love going to big games as well. But that's where I get my pleasure. And I still do that in Germany. You know, when I go to Germany and cover a big game, I make sure that I have time to go and see a smaller game too. So you'll often find me at third division games, at Regionalliga games, which is the fourth division with a regional structure, and that's what I find to be the heartbeat of the game. So from that angle. Romanticism in German, well, you're talking basically about Fußballromantik. It's quite simple, really. It's the concept of Fußballromantik is everywhere. It's in Germany, it's in the Latin countries, it's in the UK, it's in the USA. I mean, that's the thing about the USA. It's got a rich soccer, football, call it what you will, history as well, which I first discovered when I came to Boston, going all the way back to the 1860s and Oneida United. And, that's something I would like to do a lot more in this country, is go to smaller scale games. And we have a number of smaller local teams in our area here in Boston. I just never can find the time to go and watch them because I'm traveling too much. But someday when things slow down a bit more, then, we'll take care of that.
Well, here's to football romanticism. Here's to you, Derek Ray. And I'm going to let you go now because I'm sure you've got a plane to catch in a few minutes or a few hours.
For once, actually, no. For once, I'm at home and staying at home. So we chose a good day to chat.
Well, enjoy the rest of your stay in the beautiful Boston area. This has been an immense pleasure and privilege, and you're welcome back anytime, sir.
Anytime. Thanks, Nate.
And that does it for episode 2 of The Heart of the Game. Another huge thanks to Derek Ray for joining us. Be sure to follow Derek on Twitter at RayCom and follow yours truly at Nate Abarea. And of course, be sure to follow at World Soccer Talk. From the cross-border community of San Diego, California and Tijuana, Baja California, Mexico, this is Nate Abarea saying hasta la próxima. Bye for now.